Welcome, everyone, to a Baseball America podcast, the first one of 2011.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year from John Manuel and J.J. Cooper. We thank you for joining us, whether it's at baseballamerica.com or downloading us on iTunes or however you listen to the podcast. I want to remind you a couple things about Baseball America. You can join our Facebook page. You can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/baseballamerica. We're over 20,000 followers, which is exciting, so thank you very much for that. And, of course, you can always send us questions for the podcast either at Facebook or on Twitter. And lastly, before we dive into podcast proper, the podcast, as usual, brought to you by MLB Network. And this is a great time of year, whether to join us on our MLB Network offer at the Baseball America store, four issues for $4, or to buy the Almanac, which is out. The tape gun is in full effect back in the back.
Coming soon,
the Prospect Handbook, JJ, which we put finally to bed on Monday. The last vestiges of it put to bed on Monday.
The proofs were done, yeah.
Final proofs done on Monday. The supplement finally done on Tuesday. And the supplement is if you order directly from Baseball America, either by calling 800-845-2726 or at the Baseball America online store, baseballamerica.com, you get, not only do you get 900 scouting reports, you get 930 scouting reports. You get a bonus
931.
Tsuyoshi Nishioka is in the appendix.
Yes.
And so you get an extra 31st player for each of your organizations. So that all said, we, of course, like to look at the future here at Baseball America, and that's what the Prospect Handbook is all about. But this week, and we'll look at the future, we'll talk about the National League Central top 10 prospects. JJ and I both did an organization in the NL Central, and we'll talk about all six top 10s, at least in brief, in this podcast. But the big news of the week in baseball, even getting more play than the NFL playoffs in some quarters, was the Hall of Fame voting. And J.J., Burt Blyleven and Roberto Alomar in. Nobody else in, but those two guys and Pat Gillick will be inducted this summer in Cooperstown. We're actually working on a book with the Hall of Fame, which we're very honored to be part of and look forward to finishing that up this month. So we've got another book project, but this one in conjunction with the Hall of Fame, and we're writing some bios for that, and that's a pretty neat project for us. But, J.J., if you were to pick one of those two bios, which one would you rather write, the Behome Blyleven or the Roberto Alomar?
I'd probably say I wouldn't mind writing either one, but Alomar is the better player, I think.
Yep.
I don't think there's much of a doubt on that, and that's nothing against Blyleven. But Alomar, this year over 90%, and it was kind of like apparently he got put in a one-year penalty box. And then now he's been released from that, and everyone goes, well, yes, he was the best second baseman of his generation, arguably. So, hey, here you go, Hall of Fame.
Who are the other best second basemen that he's competing with there? I guess Lou Whitaker's on the ballot.
But
they were sort of contemporaries, but not a whole lot.
Whitaker's kind of his career was
10 years ahead of time.
Tailing off as
Ryne Sandberg was a little ahead of Alomar, but they were somewhat contemporaries.
If you wanted to argue, I mean, you could very well argue that Alomar, like those are the. Like the best second baseman of the late 80s, early 90s, and Alomar was the best second baseman of the 90s.
Here's his big competition in this era, I think, Jeff Kent.
Yeah.
Jeff Kent in the Hall of Fame
players.
Is going to be a pretty interesting debate. Burt Blyleven, to me, defines borderline Hall of Famer.
Right.
It took him 15 years, justifiably so. I think he's not a slam dunk Hall of Famer. Obviously, he's in now. I think a lot of our listeners and readers realize that Rich Lederer and BaseballAnalyst.com, that blog, has done a lot for Burt Blyleven's cause. Blyleven has named Rich Lederer in a couple of interviews, just saying that really helped his case, and it certainly did. Did you feel at the end of the day that Burt Blyleven deserved to be in the Hall of Fame?
Yeah, I did, but at the same time, it's one of those. I love there's a lot of outrage that seems like the Hall of Fame always generates outrage. And let's say this to one thing, to credit. There is no other Hall of Fame out there that matters like the Baseball Hall of Fame does. There's not that same outrage because
the only time you ever hear about the Basketball Hall of Fame is when someone goofs during the speech, like Michael Jordan.
But beyond that, I don't think anyone could off the top of their head go, hey, last year, the Basketball Hall of Fame, who was inducted?
Now, have you ever been to Canton, by the way?
I have been to Canton. I've not been to Cooperstown yet.
You haven't been to Cooperstown?
No,
even though your fantasy team was Cooperstown bound?
I know.
Come on.
I know. I haven't been to New York very often.
I haven't been to Cooperstown in a long time. I went in 1998, which was a good year to go. And then I've been to the Hockey Hall of Fame in Toronto, which is phenomenal, to be honest with you, even though it's in the basement of a mall. Part of it's in the basement of a mall. The rest of it is in this former bank building, which is just – it's a tremendous building and a great setup of the plaques.
The best way to explain this is back in my more traveling days when I, you know, was not married with kids, which
yes.
you don't just go off on jaunts.
Correct.
I had friends from college who lived in Ohio, so
ah.
it was easy to make a trip there. I did not have any friends who lived in New York to where I could
– You didn't know Matt Eddy yet.
No, did not know Matt Eddy yet. So.
But I think we both agree that, like, the Hall of Fame – isn't harmed by having Burt Blyleven in, but it wouldn't have been harmed by his exclusion
right.
either.
And that's the thing is, I was going to say, there's a lot of outrage that goes along with the Hall of Fame every year, it seems like. And really, one of the things that comes down to is that there are guys who are borderline Hall of Famers, and I do think it's fair to say that you can't get too upset one way or the other. Like, Burt Blyleven straddles that line.
Yeah, you're right.
He's
right on that line for me.
And, you know, is he above it and Jack Morris below it? Well, yeah, maybe. But at the same time, it's one of those questions also. The Hall of Fame is different for different people. Some people want an expansive Hall of Fame. Some
right.
people want a very compact Hall of Fame that's the true elite of the elite. You know,
and that and those people, that latter group, are SOL, JJ, because that Hall of Fame doesn't exist already.
Once the Veterans Committee said, hey, we're
exactly.
going to get in, if you played baseball in 1930, we're going to try to get you in. Because, look, you hit 300.
That's it. And if someone wants to try to start their own museum or their own different Hall of Fame with a different name and make it the Inner Circle Hall of Fame Museum, you know, be our guest. No one's stopping you. But the Hall of Fame, I'll paraphrase Donald Rumsfeld as I did on a sports talk show yesterday. You go to the BBWA goes out with the Hall of Fame that they've got, not the Hall of Fame they want.
Well, but
it's just that is the Hall of Fame already has a lot of guys in it who don't deserve to be in there, and most of them were elected by the veterans, not the writers.
And go beyond that. The reality of it is that if you want that elite Hall of Fame, financially that doesn't work. The Baseball Hall of Fame wants people to be inducted because if you announce, hey, this year we're inducting Pat Gillick,
right?
And no one else. No one's coming to the Hall of Fame for that. Nothing against Pat Gillick, but there's a whole lot less people coming for that than, you know, hey, I grew up as a fan of Burt Blyleven or of Roberto.
No, absolutely.
You know, and so the Baseball Hall of Fame wants people to be elected to the Hall of Fame. It's not something where they
want a big hall. They don't want a small hall.
It's not crafted to say, hey, every 4 or 5 years we will bring in this player who does rank in the pantheon of the greatest 25 players of all time.
Right. Now, they definitely are going to we'll see how many Torontonians – is that how you say it? I should have asked Alexis Brudnicki while she was here. But you're going to have Gillick and Alomar, obviously both very tied into the Blue Jays. And those back-to-back World Series are going to be there this year. And then I think a lot of Twins fans are going to go – for Blyleven, since he's very closely associated with them from his time playing for the Twins and also now as a broadcaster.
And so we have to move on to the bigger topic, though, which is
who didn't get in.
Who didn't get in.
What votes they did or didn't get, JJ. No, you're right. I mean, I guess I wasn't shocked that no one else got in. I almost want to go let's talk about the non-steroid guys first. But the steroid era is clearly the biggest elephant in the Hall of Fame room. Barry Larkin, he's going to be a Hall of Famer.
He's going to be a Hall of Famer. And you
deservedly
know what? He
so.
Should be a Hall of Famer.
I agree.
He was, again, when we're talking about in the pre the Trinity shortstop
yep.
era. You know,
pre
before,
Jeter, Nomar, A-Rod.
And now Nomar still gets lumped in with that. But
doesn't deserve to be.
You know, obviously not in the same group now, but he was at the time. Before that, Barry Larkin was the best shortstop in baseball.
Right.
I mean, and there wasn't really – and that was one of those that there wasn't a debate.
I do wonder why Barry Larkin 62% and Alan Trammell
24%.
I don't quite get that. You know, Alan Trammell had a 110 OPS plus for his career in an era when shortstops didn't do that often.
No one.
I think he suffers in comparison to Cal Ripken and to Robin Yount, even though he was a pretty similar player to those guys and was – to me, more of a Hall of Famer than Jack Morris from that 84 Tigers team, from that same contemporary Tigers era. But I'm not sure how – I'm not a huge – like again, I don't think the Hall of Fame is wounded without Alan Trammell, but I don't see how he's so less deserving than Barry Larkin.
But let me ask you, Kate, you know, and you brought up Jack Morris.
I'm a strong no
I mean,
on Jack Morris. I actually feel the Hall of Fame would be worse off with him in it.
And – you know, I feel like he shouldn't be in. I don't think I would, you know, I don't think he would necessarily even be the worst guy in the Hall of Fame if he got in, because, again,
he'd be in the bottom 10%.
But he would, yes, he would not be.
He'd be like in the bottom 5%.
The best way is, it's like, you can go into the ERA and all that, and that's all valid points, but go beyond that. And I think the point that you've been making around the office is that he wasn't at the time as well regarded as some people almost want to make him out to be now.
It doesn't seem that way. I mean, I didn't cover, I was 12 in
right.
1984. I just remember when when you read about the Tigers in the mid 80s, yeah, you talked about Jack Morris, you read about it, but you just as often talked about Whitaker and Trammell as the identity of the team, and the best player on the team was Kirk Gibson. The guy that Sparky Anderson always talked about was Kirk Gibson. On the 84 team, they did have a Cy Young Award winner and an MVP, and they were both Xavier Hernandez, Guillermo Hernandez. Thank you, Xavier Hernandez. That's funny.
Yeah.
Guillermo Hernandez, the left-handed reliever.
You got your drum bulls, you know.
I do. But I mean, who's their left-handed reliever? It wasn't Jack Morris. I mean, it's just a lot of revisionist history.
I was going to say that. Although, as far as Cy Young and all the time, I think if you redid Cy Young balloting now, it may work out a little differently. Not that Jack Morris would have won
but that's not the point. We're not redoing it now.
Yeah.
We're talking about how
he
was viewed at the time.
Right.
I don't think he was thought of as the Hall of Famer on that team at the time. Even Lance Parrish seemed like he was just as much a part of the identity of that club. And Darrell Evans, you want to talk about an underrated Tiger. Darrell Evans, one of the big, more underrated players of all time, was a big part of those teams as well. So, I mean, to me, Jack Morris, he doesn't sniff Hall of Fame for me. He was a really good player, but he's not even as good as guys like Blylevin or Don Sutton, who are often derided as just guys who just aggregated. But one of the things they aggregated was a lot of strikeouts.
Well,
they didn't just stay out there and put up the 390 ERA. Like, I'm very strongly against Jack Morris. I just don't think he was good enough.
And there is something to be said, by the way, as far as the guys who aggregate their way to the Hall of Fame. There's something to be said for that, because to do that, I'm not saying that that's always justifiable, but at the same time, to do that, what you are is you are a player who was considered quality enough to be a starter for 20-plus years.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with being an aggregator as long as you aggregate a lot. he didn't even aggregate as much as, again, the guys that he's frequently compared to, Sutton and Sutton and Blylevin. I mean, to me, the ERA is one part of it. He just is not a big strikeout guy, and the black numbers, he just really fails the black number test.
The best way I put it is, you don't – ERA isn't everything, but at the same time, when you're talking about a guy in the era that he pitched who never had an ERA under 3,
yeah,
that's
hard to do.
That's hard to say, hey, this guy was – the best.
Who of the guys, let's try to get to the steroid part in a minute, but of the guys who didn't get in, JJ, who would you like to see in non-steroid accusation category?
Barry Larkin, I mean, I think we both agree,
yep.
Like I said, he's going to get in.
I agree.
The other guy, and I think he seems like he's going to be the next Burt Blylevin, I really do think, is Tim Raines.
I agree.
But the thing about it is growing up, as we both did, in the 80s,
yep.
And loving baseball throughout
yep.
the 80s, Tim Raines. Okay, Ricky Henderson was – I'm on a podcast here, so imagine my hand going up high, and then imagine my hand going up a little bit lower than that.
Yeah.
During the 80s, Tim Raines wasn't Ricky Henderson, because Ricky Henderson is one of the – Ricky Henderson's the greatest lead hitter of all time.
And before Barry Bonds, you would have made an argument. If you wanted to say Ricky Henderson was the second-best left fielder of all time or third-best with Williams and Musial, you would have put him in that argument.
But Tim Raines was he wasn't that guy, but he was the best leadoff hitter type player in the National League, throughout most of that stretch. And I always with him, I mean, it's maybe a little bit unfair to say this, but I do feel like that his career was somewhat, if you want to say, wounded, but the collusion era really hit him hard.
I agree.
He was almost Exhibit A of collusion, because when he hit free agency, he happened to hit free agency at the point where, no one was allowed to sign.
Yeah.
The owners agreed that no one was going to sign anyone.
I mean, Jack Morris was also a victim of collusion as far as they were both free agents that off season, as was Andre Dawson. But
Raines missed
right.
time because
yeah,
of that.
Yeah, he missed the whole first month of the 87 season. And then he came back on national TV against the Mets and had a monster game to start that year. The other thing I think that hurts Raines' case is that his best work by far – was then in Montreal. And I was on a radio show in Calgary the other day I think it's 960 The Fan. I'm on there a decent amount. And the Calgary host just wanted to ask me about the Blue Jays, Blue Jays, the Blue Jays, and I mentioned Tim Raines and Larry Walker. And where I think that Tim Raines and Larry Walker's cases are hurt by the fact that when they were young and at their best health-wise, they both were Expos, and I think they were under the radar big time as Expos. And I think it hurt them a lot more than it hurt Robbie Alomar to be a Blue Jay.
But the argument I will make, I'll play both sides of the fence here. The argument I'll make against Raines is that Raines' career was like a better version of Dale Murphy's career in some ways, in that his peak early was really, really good.
Right, then he settled into being just a decent player.
Right.
I mean, a good player,
right.
not
but,
a great
but
player.
But you basically look at, you know, from pretty much like age 30 on, he was a guy, you know, he was solid. I mean, but he wasn't that same spectacular player that he was. And part of it also was is that, hey, he lived through the start of the steroid era,
right.
And his style of play became less, you know.
Well, he was really, really good in the 80s. He was a great player in the 80s. He was just good in the 90s.
Right.
I mean, when he went to the White Sox, he had one very good year with the White
but
Sox.
But he was largely.
He was seen as a disappointment
right.
when he went to the White Sox. He was not the guy that he was in Montreal, wasn't the game changer. There was also kind of like the little funky period where he just wanted to call me Rock.
Right.
Don't call me Tim. You know, thing colors it for me. I think a lot of people think of him as like, yeah, he was great with the Expos, but it didn't last long enough. He was just okay with the White Sox, and then he was a role player with the Yankees.
And I'll admit, I'll bring my personal bias into it. I grew up in Georgia in the 80s, so, I mean, I got to see Dale Murphy. You know, I guess pretty much wherever you were, you got to see Dale Murphy play a lot
right.
if you wanted to, because
right.
he was on TBS all the time. But if you say, you know, was Raines' peak as good as Murphy's? No, I don't. I think Murphy's peak was better. I will say Raines.
It was shorter, though.
It was shorter, and Raines' decline was more gradual than Murphy's. But
I agree with you there as well, and I also think that Murphy gets points for being in center field. For me, I'd take Dale Murphy over Jim Rice, who got in 2 years ago.
Right.
Again, I don't think the Hall of Fame is going to be a worse place if Dale Murphy never makes it, and he's never going to make it. But I could see if Dale Murphy made the Hall of Fame, I'd be fine with it. I'm with you. To me, the three guys who didn't get in yet, who aren't related to steroids at all, who I think deserve to be in the most, are Barry Larkin, Alan Trammell, and Tim Raines. I think Trammell, it just the more you read about it, the harder it is to find shortstops to put up his kind of offensive numbers. And he was a key player on winning teams. That's
the best way to put it
like
is if you erase from your memory the last 30, 25 years of baseball, and then, you know, Alan Trammell was the kind of guy that you didn't see for, like, the previous 30 years before him.
Yeah, he was rare. He was a great defender who could really hit. That's hard to find at shortstop.
But,
just a good defender. I mean, it's like he won, piled up the gold gloves.
Now,
but the elephant in the room is the steroids guys, JJ. I mean,
which quite clearly, hey, if you have a – if there is a hint of steroids in your background, it is very hard to get in right now.
So Jeff Bagwell, 41.7%. I mean, I don't know if I'd call it character assassination. I don't know if I'd call it hypocrisy. I definitely would say it was lame. All the articles written about, here's my votes and here's what I did with Bagwell. He's never been linked to it. He's just
right.
a suspect
basically,
guy.
Basically, because I think we both agree. If you said we're not talking, you know, that just take the we erase steroids from the game,
right.
And say okay, just on the basis of what he did, Jeff Bagwell's a Hall of Famer. Right?
I think he's a Hall of Famer. I think he's an easy Hall of Famer. I mean, he doesn't have 500 home runs, so maybe for some guys, he doesn't have 3,000 hits and 500 home runs like Rafael Palmeiro does. So maybe he's not as obvious in that way as Palmeiro, but he was clearly a better player,
but also, and
a
he
more
also
dominant
played,
player.
And he also played, you know,
most of his career in the Astros,
right? Which is yeah,
that's the reason why he doesn't have 500 home runs.
Right. But, I mean, on the bigger subject, like, you call it character assassination, there is a pretty big issue here, which is it's not just if you tested positive for steroids.
It's if you looked the wrong way, basically.
It's at this point, and, you know, again, I think we have some disagreements here as far as, to me, it becomes so complicated to where you draw that line. You know, because you're hearing guys say, you know, we were watching MLB Network, they're having
right.
a discussion, and it's like, and the argument.
John Heyman was the one making the point.
Was making the point, hey, I'll vote a guy in if he was a Hall of Famer before he used steroids.
I think he was specifically talking about Barry Bonds.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, I think that was the. I mean, I don't even think he was including Clemens in there, although you could.
Actually, he used the word Clemens. He did.
Oh, he said Clemens.
The Bonds
okay.
and Clemens.
For me, it's harder to know when Clemens started to use, although it seems like the answer is Toronto, you know.
Right.
I'll spare us the Batgirl Toronto reference.
By the way, we still Batgirl. If you're out there, we still.
Oh, she's tweeting. No, she's on Twitter.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah,
well,
no,
we still do love 05. We still sing it occasionally.
I would love to dig up the 05. But I will buy it for Bonds and Clemens. I think they're unique cases. Or they were Hall of Famers before they used. I think so. Clemens left the Red Sox at 190-some victories. Was clearly the best pitcher of his era already and had a 20-strikeout game 10 years apart, 86 and 96,
but
single-game record. I think even if he had just, like, had a tragic blimp accident right then, he would have gone to the Hall of Fame. That's my point.
Right.
And the same thing with Bonds. If he had a tragic blimp accident after 1998, he would have gotten in the Hall of Fame just based on that career.
But that's also a matter of timing in that their career happened to start in 1987, not 1995.
No, I understand that.
Because if their career started in 95, their entire career would be under suspicion.
It is pretty arbitrary. There's no doubt.
It's like, hey, I'm sorry, but you started in 19 – you broke in 96,
therefore – I don't dispute that it's arbitrary.
And so what my thing is that I guess I'm probably – I'm more on the side of – and this is not going to happen. I know this is not going to happen. But – maybe I'm on the extreme on this, but you know what? Let's redo the orders are given to voters.
Yeah, that's the Jason Stark position.
But
Jason Scott.
Especially because the point is to be made. This has been used in the past. You know, it's a shifting rule. Not in that the rule's the same, but Ty Cobb, first ballot.
Right.
No problem.
Yeah.
Is Ty Cobb more moral than the players who are now, you know, being held out?
Right.
I mean, yes, he did not use steroids. Steroids had not been invented, but at the same time.
Yeah, thankfully we don't have the same – we don't make the same judgments we made in the 1930s, and thankfully I'm sure there's some we make worse than –
But what I'm saying is that are we going to – you know, we don't know that we're going to look back 50 years from now and go, you know, people shrug shoulders. What I'm just saying is
that – What were they thinking back then?
Right.
No, exactly.
But
no,
what
right.
I'm saying is that – maybe make the clause much more simple, which is if you are eligible to work in baseball, hey, look at what you did, and now judge on the body of work. Now I'll say this: body of work does that still doesn't mean that you throw everything out. Dick Allen, a great player, but you could throw in like. If you are disruptive to a team.
Yeah, the fact that he lived up to his first name made him not be a Hall of Fame
right.
player.
Right. If you are disruptive to your team, you can that can be a part of it. You know,
I
if
agree.
You want to say, hey, you know what? I'm not going to vote for Jeff Kent because I don't think that Jeff Kent was a good teammate or whatever.
Right.
I don't. You can argue that point in one
you
way or another.
You can argue that all you want, Matt Kemp.
Right. But that being said, like, that still gets all wrapped in there because that's judging you on what you did in baseball.
Right.
At the same time, though.
But getting rid of the phrase character of the player.
Right, because
I'm for that. Jeff Idelson's against it.
Right.
And he matters a little bit more than we do.
But my thing is just, if you did that, what you do. I mean, because reality is we now have a Hall of Fame that, for the first time, I mean, before all this, there have been two players who were clearly Hall of Famers who've been held out.
Yeah.
And they're held out for something that, you can argue is a justifiable reason, which is if you bet on the game, that's
right.
been drawn as a black line,
yep.
and everyone else at least has managed to stay on the other side of that line or at least not get caught.
Yeah, since Joe Jackson, again, Ty Cobb is the exception
yes.
to what you're talking about, interest speaker, but yes, in general, if the commissioner's office said you gambled and you're busted on it and we're enacting punishment on you, you also don't get in the Hall of Fame.
Right.
Joe
but beyond that, if you were one of the elite, you got in.
Yes.
And nowadays, like, there's
now
no way that you can say there are players who are sitting told, no, you're not a Hall of Famer. And if there's no way that if you looked at their body of work baseball-wise that you could say that.
I do think Bagwell eventually is going to get in. Starting at 41.7%, I think is enough. I think he's going to wind up getting in. I think it's curtains for Mark McGwire. Definitely curtains for Rafael Palmeiro, Juan Gonzalez. I think this portends ill for Ivan Rodriguez.
No.
I think this is an ill wind. What do you think happens eventually to Bonds and Clemens? Do you think those guys are
going to
get in?
That's what I was going to say. If Barry Bonds doesn't get into the Hall of Fame.
He's going to go on a rampage and destroy the whole city of Cooperstown.
But
Bonds smash!
But if Barry Bonds doesn't get in the Hall of Fame, then
Roger
Clemens.
Actually, that would be Clemens. Clemens will throw a broken bat at the
But
Hall
if Bonds and Clemens don't get in, And you do reach a point where what you are saying is, hey, our Hall of Fame is, it's not the best players in baseball.
Yeah.
It's the best players as we have chosen, you know, who also, you know, get good conduct badges. I mean, and you can have it that way if you want.
Yeah.
But
that's not the Hall of Fame.
But Barry Bonds.
It's not going to be a successful Hall of Fame museum or tourist attraction, which is the whole point.
But Barry Bonds is one of, I mean, steroids or not, Barry Bonds is the best player of the last, you know, best position player of the last 40, 50 years.
Yeah, I'm definitely in the Bob Costas, let them all in, put on their plaque. And I even agree about, I even think that about Joe Jackson, Shoeless Joe, and Pete Rose as well. Let them in, put on their plaque,
but
gambled on baseball.
No, again,
Barry Bonds, you know, would never admitted it, but HGH user, possible steroid user, the clear, whatever it was. You know, Roger Clemens, yeah, put it all on there.
Now,
even Andy Pettit, if you want to put Andy Pettit in there.
And the thing
I don't.
And the thing I'll say is that, now, go that beyond, like you mentioned Juan Gonzalez and all. At the same time, if you even did that, we still have some very interesting debates to go on with the Hall of Fame because
I agree.
The offensive numbers were so inflated for a stretch of time. Like, is Juan Gonzalez a Hall of Famer? My personal thought is probably not.
Mark McGwire's borderline. Even with 583 home runs, Mark McGwire's career basically is very similar to that of Dave Kingman. Both went to USC as pitchers and hitters. Both played in the Alaska League and blossomed as hitters there. That, of course, has no relevance in them being similar big leaguers, but it is a nice coincidence. And then, you know, they both had a lot of home runs, struck out a lot. McGwire walked more. You know, he wasn't as much of a jerk.
But you know what?
Kingman.
And I was
going to
say, but by the end of his career, McGwire walked more, but his walks were not the same as – that's not the same as Tim Raines walking because once McGwire reached first base, staying on first until he –
all walks are not created equal. I mean, you look at – this is Juan Gonzalez, thanks to baseballreference.com. He had 50 home runs once – 50 doubles once. He had led the league in home runs twice. 434 career home runs. In the 90s, I'm not sure.
I don't
that
think
gets
he's.
Like
I said, my initial thought is just I just do not think of him as a. He won two MVPs. I mean, that's so you could argue, but you know, I just don't think of him as a Hall of Famer.
His career is a lot like Dale Murphy's to mine, without a little bit better offense, but that's because of the era. Not as much defensive value. Really, an inglorious end of the career on the field, and you know, you want a character, Dale Murphy. Worlds ahead of Juan Gonzalez. The one steroid guy who I think I treated really shabbily was Kevin Brown. For me, JJ, I know he was in the Mitchell Report, and he was not the favorite of any writer because he was not a good interview and seems to revel of being a jerk, the turd of the punch bowl. But all that said, I think Kevin Brown's as good or better a pitcher than Burt Blyleven.
Kevin Brown was a true ace. I mean,
yeah. He was
Kevin
the number
Brown,
one on back-to-back World Series teams.
Right. Kevin Brown was the guy.
Yeah, Marlins and Padres.
Kevin Brown was the guy who would go out there in game, you know, in the big game, in the regular season or the playoffs, and you knew if he was on, they were going to win.
The amazing part about Kevin Brown, too, since then I looked up a little bit more about Kevin Brown. You know, he signed that contract with the Dodgers, which is roundly seen as one of the worst contracts ever. You know, his first five years of that contract – for those 5 years, he was outstanding.
Right.
He wasn't.
Yeah, the only thing
just
he got hung
good.
On. The only thing that got hung up on was is that you know it was in UK. He got the money for doing this, but it was Scott Boras presented it as, oh no, he'll be fine throughout the life of this contract.
Right, which he wasn't.
He
but
wasn't.
Through the first
you know
5 years,
yeah.
He had returned. He'd given you quite a good ROI in four of those first five
right.
years.
And hey,
then he got traded to the Yankees, and it all fell apart.
But hey, but the other thing with that is just like. That happens. The Nationals know right now. If the Nationals are expecting that Jason Worth is going to be productive for the life of this contract, they're probably a little crazy. What you're hoping is that you don't get the Soriano situation where the Cubs sign Soriano knowing by year eight of this, he may not be the player we want to be putting out
eight.
There. But
by year three
they're
like,
going, oh, man, five more
caramba.
Years? Yeah.
That's where we are. Well, speaking of the Cubs, National League Central top 10 is the real reason most people subscribe to this podcast. I feel like we can't ignore the Hall of Fame stuff. I'm actually surprised how much we agreed on that stuff. But JJ, your Cincinnati Reds, one of the organizations that you do, right up there with the Chicago Cubs for best farm system in this division.
I think we have an agreement on the worst.
I think we do.
I don't think
those are
the Brewers
are the worst, and it's not. So Houston Astros fans, congratulations.
You're
no
out
longer
of the basement.
You're out of the basement for back-to-back. The last 3 years, prior to this one, the Astros farm system had ranked 30, 30, and 29. So
and I will
say this.
We've
got them at 26 in the latest handbook.
I will say this, and if you look back in hindsight, there are times we look back and go, hey, that team maybe was a little bit.
They were 30.
They
were 30 each of the last couple of years. So.
You know, and if you don't sign, you know, if you just don't sign draft picks, that's.
That's what's going to happen. If you don't sign draft picks and you're not aggressive in Latin America.
Put those together, and you've got a combo.
That's it. And the thing is, the Astros this year signed the biggest contract they ever did in the draft with Delino DeShields Jr., the second largest contract they've ever given to a pitcher for Mike Foltynewicz. I forget whose contract is higher, bonus-wise. And then the biggest contract in bonus in club history to Ariel Ovando out of the Dominican Republic. So this year they put their money where their mouth is. They spent more. I don't think it's coincidental, J.J., but they're doing that on the way out for Drayton McClain, their owner. I think Drayton McClain wanted to focus, especially after 2004, 2005, when they won, you know, had the playoff success they had, won a pennant. I think the focus was 100% on the Major League team for Drayton McClain. They never went over slot after the Troy Patton debacle. And
it's funny, you've seen this happen a couple of times.
Drew Stubbs.
You've seen this happen a couple of times in baseball, where a team, the owner's like, hey, we want to get him one more, we want to get him a ring. And usually what ends up happening is you don't get the ring, but you really leave the system in a really scary shape.
Correct. Or you had, it wasn't even the owner, but it was John Schuerholz on the way out in Atlanta. Must win one more. Take Elvis Andrews and Nathaly Feliz. I don't care. You definitely, at the end of those 10 years, you get a lot of those. Let's talk a little bit about the Reds. We just talked a little bit about the Astros. The Astros, very young farm system, some athleticism.
Improving.
It is improving, but it's baby steps.
Good ways to go.
I think it's baby steps, but Jordan Lyles is a really nice prospect. I don't think he's a future ace, but I think he's a future number two or three. And number two, if everything works out, more likely number three.
And do remember, when we even say that this guy could be a future number two, that's saying
pretty
something.
Lofty.
That's pretty lofty. And that also doesn't mean don't pencil him in as your number two start. That means he has the potential to do that.
Yep.
If we have three guys who have the potential to be a number two and one of them turns out to be a number two,
yep.
That's pretty good because there's not that many number twos out there.
He's fascinating because he has the perfect projectable frame and a good delivery. But he already is kind of maxed out with his delivery. It's not like he throws so hard that he's max effort, but like I wrote in there, he gets really good extension out front. He's got a really long stride. He releases the ball out front. Yeah, there's nothing mechanically you can really do to make him throw harder.
Right, he is what he is.
He's gonna. I think he's going to fill out a little bit more physically, but I still don't think he's going to throw a whole lot harder, maybe a tick or two. But it's really going to be an average fastball in terms of velocity with command and some life. The secondary stuff is what makes him start out. And he's kind of like the anti-Aroldis Chapman is what we're saying here.
I think we both agree Cubs and Reds will debate whether those
–
which
front.
One at the front.
They are at the front.
Okay. Brewers are the back end. And I think we both – the best way we can say with the Brewers is that this is if you're going to gut a farm system, this is a reason to gut it.
Yeah. I mean, they traded three guys would have been in their top five prospects, I guess it was, with Brett Lowry, Jake Odorizzi, and Jeremy Jeffress. So – that leaves you with guys like Scooter Gennett and Kentrell Davis that don't profile. The one guy the guys I like best in their top 10 are guys that Tom Hodricourt ranked 9th and 10th, Kyle Heckathorn and Amory Rivas. Amory Rivas doesn't have great numbers, and he's a little older, but he's got good stuff. His fastball is 92 to 95, but it's fairly straight. Pretty decent changeup, pretty decent slider. Some pitchability. I like Amory Rivas all right, and I like Kyle Heckathorn. A lot of ground balls, a lot of good sinker baller. Those guys are. I would have ranked them higher myself, but Tom knows that system better than I do.
Now, okay, how would you slot it? Said we've got Cubs and Reds at the top, Cardinals and Pirates.
I just don't like the Pirates approach, so I would say the Cardinals are better than the Pirates, and that's. I probably can't say that because the Pirates have a little bit more talent.
I'm going to go Pirates.
The Pirates have more talent, but I really don't. Do I trust them to bring the talent out? Honestly, I don't, JJ. I just don't. I'm going to stick with them. I'm going to say Cardinals for two big reasons. Shelby Miller, and they do have a lot of hard-throwing arms. I do like their arms. That's the strength of the Pirates. And I know there's Jameson Taillon. Who would you rather have, Shelby Miller or Jameson Taillon?
I probably got to go Shelby Miller just because
I will
go a guy who, if you're talking about two very similar guys, one's done it in pro ball, one's not.
Correct.
I mean, although I don't think there's a big difference. There's a big, you know, those guys, when we do our top 100, there's not going to be a huge gap between those two.
I think you're right. But I would give the edge to Shelby Miller. This Carlos Martinez joker, the Dominican right-hander the Cardinals signed, he sounds really, really, really intriguing. 96 to 99 mile an hour fastball in short stints. Tyrell Jenkins, one of the premier athletes in the draft. Seth Blair, Jordan Swaggerty, Joe Kelly, to a lesser extent, Lance Lynn. I've never been a big Lance Lynn guy. So I like their pitching. I like the Cardinals pitching all right. Not a whole lot going on there position player-wise other than Zach Cox. But I really don't like the Pirates' 2010 draft. I just
they went very heavy on young right-handers.
Yeah,
I mean,
just 2-1 note. I just don't like it. No, sir, I don't like it.
So, you know,
that's where I stand on those guys.
The problem with the Pirates, they went very high, very heavy on young right-handers, which, hey, the strength of their young talent that they've graduated is position players.
Right.
That being said, the problem, though, is that hey, these guys are ready now,
right,
and then the next wave, you know, okay, our pitching is a year behind.
Right.
We're talking pitchers who are
3 and 4 years away.
Right. And so by the time that the pitching gets there, the position players, you know, the McCutcheons, Pedro Alvarez's and all, they're going to be in the middle of their arbitration years, and by the time that the young pitching, if it all works out, gets up there and establishes itself, it's going to be at that point where you go, okay, Pedro Alvarez is heading into his sixth year.
Yeah.
And you got to decide, are you going to be able to re-up him or are you going to trade him away?
I agree. And I also think that just looking at their entire top 30, for a team that's been as bad as they've been for 17 years, it's pretty embarrassing, top 30. I mean, it's not the worst top 30 out there. But at least the Royals have been bad for a long time, and they've got a top 30 to prove it. You know, they've got draft pick after draft pick after draft pick,
well,
high draft. They spent a lot of money. So have these guys. But it's just not an impressive top 30. It's just there's not a lot of depth. There's not much at the upper levels, even though they won the AA Eastern League title at Altoona. Still not a more good players. No real prospects that are going to turn things around.
And when they traded guys away, they have not really gotten guys that you say, okay, that's a cornerstone guy that they're going to build.
I agree. Now, they've done a better job with amateur scouting than they have with professional scouting. Actually, the professional scouting department's one of the problems, just because they haven't gotten a whole lot in trades. Really question, as we did last month during the winter meetings, I questioned Josh Rodriguez in the Rule 5 draft. I mean,
you're
not going to find a ton of impact in the Rule 5, but that they didn't find any impact.
Right. That's the guy that you're like, okay, if it all works out, unless they're seeing something that no one else that we're talking to is seeing, there's not going to be an impact there.
I agree.
Your hope is that, yeah, okay, he could be a good, solid utility infielder.
Pretty much.
That's your hope.
That's
the everything worked out
right. I bet you he would have been around with their first pick in the second round, is what I'm saying, the Rule 5. But that's a whole other – I mean, we've already talked too much about the Rule 5 draft. So now we're down to – The Reds and the Cubs. Those are the two best farm systems and the most intriguing. And
I can see debates both ways on this. And, I would – looking at the 30s, I'm going to say Reds. But I do probably like – the top three in the Cubs system is, you know, matches up very well with the Reds' top three. I just think that once you get past that, like when you look at, okay, comparing like 4, 5, 6 is Hawk Julie, Josh Vitters, Chris Carpenter compared to Devin Mesoraco, Yonder Alonso, Yorman Rodriguez, you know, Chris and Yasmani Grandal. I would rather have the Reds of that because.
Completely agree. With you on that. I would take the Cubs' top three over the Reds' top three, but it's close. I'm not 100% a believer in Devin Mesoraco, as much of a good year as he had. I've only seen him play twice, and both times he was – well, three games, and all three times he was horrible. I mean, but he just was horrible. I mean, I haven't seen him receive the ball cleanly.
Right, and that was a definite problem for him late in the season. I mean, there's no way
that's when I saw him. I saw him in September and then in November in the fall league.
You know, I've talked to scouts who say, yeah, but you know what? Saw him earlier in the season. His receiving was fine. He'll be okay.
But
that is something you
have
to
catch 130 games in the major leagues.
You know, that's at least something you have to file away in your head. And the other thing you have to file away from Mesoraco, look, if you're looking at his 2010 season was as good a season as pretty much anyone in the minor leagues had.
If he'd had like just something successful previously, he would have been in the mix for minor league player of the year. It just it almost seemed like his year just came out with so much out of nowhere.
And to say this, it's coming out of nowhere from the fact of what he had produced before.
Right.
It's not coming out of nowhere. He was a first-round pick.
Right.
And he was not a shocking first-round pick. He was a consensus first-round talent who went in the first round.
Right, absolutely.
But it was, like, it was so way beyond anything. He never slugged over 400 before
right.
the season. He
That's
slugged
it.
Over 600 this year.
That's it.
But again, it's close. Like, if you said Aroldis Chapman versus Chris Archer.
Yeah, I'm taking Chapman.
I'm taking Chapman. Although, you know, the thing with Chapman, the interesting thing, got a lot of questions in the chat about this. He, you know, Walt Jocke's come out and said, Aroldis Chapman is going to be a reliever this year.
Yeah.
You know, that, which, see, you know, and fans understandably are looking at that going, but he's got the potential as a starter and all that.
Right.
Here's the reality of it. They have, right now, going into spring training, they have six starters who started 12 or more games for them last year
right.
with ERAs under 4.5 who they have to sort out to pick five. Right now, I mean, my best guess is Mike Leake's going to be pitching out of the pen or pitching in AAA at the start of the year.
That's just shocking
and,
to me after what
Mike,
the kind of start he had last year.
Right, and that's nothing against Mike Leake. That's not like,
yeah.
oh, they're tired, they don't like Mike Leake anymore. It's just, well, Travis Wood came up in the second half season, and Travis Wood was even better
was
in the
awesome.
Second half
yeah.
than Mike Leake was in the first
Absolutely.
Half.
Absolutely.
Well,
And
that
he's
being,
left-handed, which they can use.
That being said, your choices are either you send Chapman back to the minors to start, or you put him in your pen, and they just lost Arthur Rhodes.
Right.
Development matters a lot, but the reality of it is that the major league club has a vote.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Dusty Baker's not saying, okay, well, yeah, we'll see him again in September.
I mean, didn't they just sign Edgar Renteria? The reports are they signed Edgar Renteria. That's not a move for the future.
No.
That's a move for 2011.
But
so
I will
you.
Say, from what I understand, this does not preclude that in 2012 spring training, they may not say, here, let's put you back
right.
in the mound as a starter or, you know, this doesn't say the door is closed for
does
Chapman
your,
to ever start.
Does your gut say that Chapman can be a starter? Just put him in a
yeah.
vacuum that he can start
oh, yeah.
and be an effective starter?
The problem is that I think it's the same thing. Like it's somewhat similar. I don't think it's going to happen because
who would you compare him to as a starting pitcher, as a major league starting pitcher?
I mean, the only guy, the guy who always gets comped to because it's a, there's
right.
even though you know Randy Johnson is 5 inches taller.
Right. Right.
But the
At
only
least.
Guy, if, yeah, five or six,
six.
Yeah, yeah, because yeah, Chapman's 6'4", so
okay, so seven,
seven, yeah, because 6'10", 6'11", yeah, but, and that's because, you know, hard throwing lefty, with you know with two nasty pitches,
right.
and at that point, I mean that you can.
He's like a harder throwing John Candelaria, or you know,
but. Well, although Candy had like six pitches, didn't he? You know,
I think so. But he had the lower.
He also had six
too.
Pitches that he could put in his hand
yeah,
at one
that's
time.
It.
But the thing with Chapman though is that the problem you're going to run into. We've seen this with Naftali Feliz. We may see this in with the White Sox too
yeah.
with Chris Sale. If you have success as a reliever, there you know he and Chapman has shown. Okay, he can probably have success as a reliever right now. It's really hard to stop things
yeah.
and say, you know what. We're going to take it slow.
Especially when your team is good.
Right.
Like the Reds.
The Reds are a playoff contender for next year. They have to be. They won the division last year, and they're bringing back essentially the same team.
I think they're still the favorites in that division for me.
Right.
I don't think the Cardinals have gotten better this offseason. In fact, I think they've gone backwards. I mean, Milwaukee's made obviously a big step forward getting grinded.
But they had needed a big step forward.
They did. They were 15th in the National League
and
in pitching.
And the thing about that for the Reds is that the Reds won that division last year, and I think we all agree – they won that about a year before.
Yeah.
I think the general feeling was, you look at all the young talent they had, hey, 2011, they should be really good. Well, they won it last year.
Yeah.
So what's going to happen now is it's
Jay
like,
Bruce still hasn't had his big year yet.
Right. If
it's
Jay
coming.
Bruce has his big year
it's coming.
This year, and Joey Votto just comes close to what he did last
yeah.
year, then you've got an you've got an insane middle of your lineup.
And, of course, another big issue for them it seems to be you got to keep Scott Rowland healthy.
Right,
and I like the way that that Dusty Baker always talks about it is, you know, Scott Rowland's going to play 120 games, and that's a smart approach.
And the thing
I hope that Todd Frazier is his backup.
And the thing that I'll say is when you look at their top 10, you look at their top 15. Not all these guys are going to be Cincinnati Reds at the end
right.
of this year. I feel confident saying that.
Good point.
Because what's going to happen, or what you'll be shocked if it didn't happen, is when you get to June, July. Yonder Alonso, I mean, like, they have – these are – we're talking – I'm just going to list big league ready guys, like
yeah.
guys who have had a full year pretty much in AAA.
This is why I think the Reds farm system is a little bit better than the Cubs. Is also the top of the Cubs list is better, but the Reds have a little bit better depth, and especially at the top levels, they have more big league ready talent.
Yonder Alonso,
yep.
Juan Francisco, Zach Cozart, Todd Frazier, Matt Maloney, Sam LeCure. And look, Maloney and LeCure do not qualify anymore. They just edged over the.
Okay.
I mean, LeCure does. I'm sorry, LeCure does, but Maloney doesn't. But those guys, they could trade all of those guys away. And you could argue that none of those is a true elite player. Alonso's
right.
The closest to that.
Right.
But they could trade every single one of those guys away and not impact their big league club in any way, shape, or form because none of those guys are projected, you know, right now to start for them. Cozart would be the closest. He's got a chance to take it from Paul Yonish, but more
and
likely
Edgar
he's going
Renteria.
To be in AAA because
right.
Edgar Renteria is going to be there too.
Right.
But so they can trade all those guys away to bring in whatever piece they need. And that's not even counting, by the way, they've, you know, Dave Sapel, Chris Heisey, you know, those
yeah,
guys who,
good point.
Like, they could trade Chris Heisey in a deal. Hey, we need a leadoff hitter. And Chris Heisey, essentially, at this point, is a useful big leaguer.
Yeah.
So
I agree. No, they've got, it's a nice luxury to have. They have a lot of big league ready talent. And a lot of those guys are spare parts for them.
And the thing that they have that I'll be interested to see what goes on this year is beyond that 10, then, I mean, they've got a lot of kind of a little bit lower ceiling but ready to play big leaguer guys at the upper levels. Then there's this gap. But
yeah.
Then they have what's going to be that Dayton club
yeah.
is a lot of high ceiling guys.
Their rookie ball team was interesting this year.
Right.
They're two rookie ball clubs.
You know, Billy Hamilton,
I think, is one of the most exciting guys in the big league. I think you're absolutely right. You pegged Billy Hamilton in your chat about it as a guy who you could just see exploding in 2011 and being a guy who steals like 90 bases and people are like, who is this guy? Where'd this come from? Billy Hamilton's a great pick there, I think. So
that's
he has the tools, the speed, and the slashing hitting ability
to
explode in 2011.
And the good thing about what he has is there's guys out there. I mean, every organization, or almost every organization.
Well, you do the Royals, so you know about
yeah,
all these guys.
Every organization, you know, the Royals could line up, you know, seven guys who have 80 speed.
That's right.
But the thing about it is Billy Hamilton has 80 speed and the baseball acumen to go with it.
That would only be good if Baseball America somehow could put together the minor league version of the superstars.
Yes. Yeah.
The Royals win the sprinting events again.
But Billy Hamilton.
Who'd win tug of war? Whoever has, someone will sign Calvin Pickering just for tug of war.
I was gonna say Juan Francisco. You want him on your
that's
team?
That's pretty good, absolutely.
You want your team on your team in tug of war?
Why not?
But on the Cubs, you know this Cubs list. Also, though, the thing about it is if we were ranking this a year from now, the Cubs list we could flip on this as far as just looking at these current top tens because they have some guys who are a little further away.
Yeah, they do. You know, the Cubs list is pretty interesting. Obviously, Jim Cowell is not here to speak for his Cubs list. You know,
Simpson, number 8, is a guy that jumps out to me. Like,
well, Caesar at number 7.
Yeah.
Matt Caesar ranking ahead of Hayden Simpson, which
Simpson was not a consensus.
He was a consensus 3rd to 5th
yes.
rounder. He was not a consensus 1st rounder. The story of how they took him is awesome. But Matt Caesar, also not a consensus high draft pick, a football player, and
just was playing
dynamic.
In the 1AA
FCS,
playoffs.
That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, he is so dynamic. He has such dynamic tools. You know, and I like Chris Carpenter. He might be in the bullpen. To me, it's amazing that the Cubs have the biggest payroll and the biggest budget in this division, and yet they need their farm system the most because I have a feeling that and they have new ownership the last couple of years with the Ricketts. They have a longtime general manager in Jim Henry, who has this foot in player development, but also has the Soriano contract you talked about, the Carlos Zambrano contract, a lot of bad contracts that he has doled out in Chicago that really restrict him in what he can do in the offseason. And he really needs some of these guys to come through. He needs Brett Jackson and Chris Archer to be contributors in 2011 or 2012. He needs, whether it's Darwin Barney or Hawk Julie or someone else to come up with Starlin Castro, who they rushed last year, but he's already the best shortstop in the NL Central. But they need those guys to come up because no one's going to take their Soriano. No one's going to take
right.
Zambrano off their hands. And the other bad, you know, Ryan Dempster makes a lot of money. So they need Trey McNutt and Chris Archer to come through. It's pretty amazing that the situation they need their farm system more than most high payroll teams do.
The best way to put this is in this division, the Cubs should be dominant because
yeah.
they happen to be in a division where that is largely filled with small, what are considered now small revenue or mid revenue teams.
They are the biggest market by a lot.
And you know, St. Louis.
Well, I guess Houston,
but Houston is not, you know, and Houston spent some money too in
right.
crazy ways too.
That's
but,
right.
But like if the Reds had $10 more million of payroll room.
Yeah, I'd make a big difference. They'd have Zach Greinke.
I think that if they had $10 more million in room, I think that they matched up pretty well. They could have gone to the Royals and said,
"We'll take your Lorenzo Cain and we'll see your Lorenzo Cain and raise you a Drew Stubbs."
Right. They could have say that they could have in that said, "Hey, you know what? You want middle infield? You want middle talent? You want catcher? Okay, you pick Devin Mesoraco, Yasmani Grandal. You want pitching to go with this?
Right.
You know what? See what Mike Leake did last year? Well, you know,
exactly.
You pick Mike Leake or Travis Wood.
Right.
You know, they could do things like that, which, hey, if you have to give up Travis Wood but you get Zach Greinke, you do that.
You do it.
But the thing about it is that that's not really an option for the Reds because they were already at, you know, they went into the offseason going, okay, you've got a very little bit of payroll room.
That's why they don't have Arthur Rhodes anymore,
right.
among other reasons.
Right.
They wanted him.
And what they're talking about is, you know, they were hoping to get Arthur Rhodes at like 3-4 mil, and this year that's not, you know.
Not happening.
And then once that happens, like, hey, we've got money to now go out and sign Edgar Renteria. Well, you're shopping the bargain bin when your money
yeah.
that comes open is you can get Edgar Renteria at this point.
At least it's a good thing for baseball when Edgar Renteria, no offense to Edgar Renteria, but he's no longer commanding $11 million contracts. He's signed some pretty big contracts the last few years of his career. But no, I agree. I think I agree with you. I think I would give the Reds a slight edge over the Cubs, but those are the two best farm systems in the division by a lot.
I know we need to wrap this up, but I just want to say, you know, like we'll have coming up on the website and in the magazine, did a story for this issue about the other thing that jumps out with the Reds is that
oh, yeah, pitching.
They're producing pitching now. Which
yeah, has not happened since the days of Mario Soto. I was there for Brett Tomko's first professional start. He was a Charleston Alley Cat, I believe. Was that what the West Virginia team
yeah,
was known
yeah.
by at that time? And they played in Hickory in the South Atlantic League. And second round out of Florida Southern, the Mox, played for the legendary and late coach Chuck Anderson down there.
And until Johnny Cueto and Homer Bailey came up, that was the last starter that the Reds drafted and produced.
And again, they traded him for good reason. They traded him for Ken Griffey. That's how he left town. So that was worthwhile. But the next podcast, JJ, will actually be our first off-season college baseball podcast, reunited, and it feels so good. Aaron Fitt, I'm not with Aaron in Nashville this weekend, but Aaron's at the ABCA Coaches Convention. So next week, Aaron and I are going to hook up either on Skype or Google Chat or whatever, and we'll do a college baseball podcast. It might even be on a Monday. Who knows?
Okay.
But we will talk about this college offseason, the Cal baseball decision to drop baseball, and the resulting transfer of Eric Jaffe to UCLA, which is a big deal. Recruiting rankings are up for that if you want to talk about that. We'll talk about Arizona State's suspension, and then we'll talk about these potential rules changes. We have the postseason that could change after 2011, the postseason format, and, of course, bats, which is
gonna
so
be,
exciting
I mean,
to
I was
going to
say, 2011 is going to be a fascinating year to watch college baseball.
There's a lot going on, and we will then that'll build us up toward the 2011 season, but a little housekeeping in the off season for 2010-11.
Yeah, we've got to tidy everything up for the off season before we dive
absolutely.
Into previews.
Absolutely, but we'll have an off season college podcast next week, and then in a month, the college preview issues here, and that will be another. We'll kick off another
that'll
year of college podcast. Absolutely. So look to that, and if you have questions for the college side, you can send those to us at podcast@baseballamerica.com. Thanks again to MLB Network for sponsoring the Baseball America podcast. And thanks to J.J. Cooper for co-hosting here with me, John Manuel, on the Baseball America podcast. Until next week, we'll see you next time. So long, everybody.